I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's been just over a year since Tunisia's Jasmine Revolution ousted the country's longtime leader. That's considered the dramatic start to what's become known as the Arab Spring. In just a few minutes, we will hear from the son of a prominent Iranian dissident. He'll talk about his father's letter to Tunisians warning of the lessons of the Iranian Revolution. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we want to check in on some of the pressing stories throughout the Middle East and the surrounding region. A year after the start of the Arab Spring, Syria's government continues to cling to power, using violence to suppress protests there. In Egypt, a prominent moderate has dropped out of its presidential race, and increasing tensions between the U.S. and Iran are putting the whole region on edge. Joining us to talk about these issues once again is Abdurrahim Fukara. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International. He's a frequent guest on this program for conversations about the Middle East. Thank you so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Let's talk first about Syria. It's been 10 months since protests began there. Demonstrators and their sympathizers are still being attacked and killed by government troops. Now, it's hard to know exactly how many because news reports are so heavily restricted. But this weekend, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon used some very strong language. And I'm quoting here. He said, "I say again to President Assad of Syria, stop the violence, stop killing your people." Is there any evidence that he's listening?
Yes and no. I mean, he knows that the pressure has been compounding, and obviously he's been counting on the Russians and the Chinese to help him out. And I think what Ban Ki-moon was saying there, he was talking as much to Bashar as he was talking to the Security Council. And he wants the Security Council to act in unison in terms of, you know, the killing that's happening in Syria. Now we're talking about over 5,000 people killed in Syria over the last 10 months. And we don't even know how accurate that number is. But there are signs that he's listening, Bashar is listening. But there are also signs that he still feels that he can deal with the situation with these security measures and bring it to an end.
Now let's go to Egypt there. In Egypt, a high-profile candidate has dropped out of the running for the presidency there. This is a person I think many people in the West, a name they will know, Mohamed El-Bari. He won the Nobel Prize for his work with the International Atomic Energy Agency in 2005. He said that the people running the country are holdovers from the Hosni Mubarak regime. What do you think it means that he dropped out of the race, and what does that suggest for the upcoming presidential elections?
Well, I mean, first of all, Al-Baradei has always been looked at by Egyptians in two different ways. One way is that they've always been proud of him. He's the face of Egypt internationally. He was the head of the International Atomic Agency. Very proud that an Egyptian was in that position. But there was also the other way of looking at him, which is that he is an outsider. And he came from overseas. Many Egyptians thought that he came overseas with, if not an outside agenda, then at least a foreign perspective on Egyptian politics. So when he dropped out, a lot of people thought that in Egypt felt that he was sending a clear message that the transition is not happening the way it should have been happening, that the military are intent on clinging to power. But a lot of them thought, who does he think he is? He comes from outside and then he wants to run against Islamist movements that are well entrenched in the country, that have always been present, that were repressed under the previous regime, and who were very active socially in terms of providing health and education. But I think overall, it says, regardless of how he's moved to drop out of the race, I think it sends a serious message that something has gone seriously wrong since the so-called revolution that started a year ago.
At least in terms of the diversity of political perspectives that are to be part of the immediate next future of Egypt.
Absolutely. I mean, there was, in the initial stages of the revolution, led by young people who did not particularly subscribe to any particular ideology, the hope was that the Islamist parties, if there were a free and fair election, would get 25 to 30% of the vote. And we have seen that they went well beyond that. We're talking about 65 to 70% of the vote, not just for the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist parties. Whereas the liberals, such as Al-Baradei and others, have not actually done so well. But this is a process, obviously. The people in the region feel that this is a process, the end of which we do not know how it's going to actually be.
And finally, another conflict which seems to open it at the moment, these increasing tensions between the U.S. and Iran, over the Straits of Hormuz, where Iran is threatening to close it. You know, I think a fifth of the world's daily trade oil passes through there every day. How serious a situation is this? Or is just one of these episodic wars of words that seems to erupt between these two countries every now and again?
There are a lot of people in the region who were seriously worried about the current rhetoric between the United States and Iran, particularly in places such as Saudi Arabia. There's been a sort of cold war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of fear in Israel. Among the Arabs, there's a feeling that maybe the war, the ratcheting it up of the rhetoric, is to put pressure on the Iranians, because that's what the Israelis want. But there are so many people who want that.
We have to leave it there for now. Abdul Rahim, thank you so much for joining us once again. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera International. So many important stories, so little time, and he was here with us in Washington, D.C.
It's good to be with you.
We want to turn now to a personal story to mark the anniversary of the Arab Spring, and it is something of a cautionary tale. Ibrahim Yazdi was the first foreign minister of Iran after the 1979 revolution. He was quickly sidelined by clerics and eventually became a critic of Islamic hardliners in Iran. Now Yazdi faces an 8-year prison sentence for criticizing the government. That happened in part because of a letter he wrote warning the leader of Tunisia's moderate Islamist party to watch out for the rise of fundamentalists in that government. We wanted to know more about what lessons Mr. Yazdi wanted to pass on, so we've called upon his son, Yusuf Yazdi. He is the head of the Center for Bioengineering Innovation and Design at Johns Hopkins University, and he's with us now in Washington. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I just have to wonder that this must be a time of great anxiety for you, so I did want to ask how you are.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very stressful, difficult time, but amazingly, when I talk to my parents in Tehran, they're very strong-willed, positive, and they're the ones who are giving us emotional support rather than the other way around.
That is the way parents are, aren't they? But I do want to ask you to go back a little bit in history, because I think it will be a surprise to many Americans thinking about that period that there was ever any struggle at all in Iran after the revolution between the hardliners and others. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it went by so fast that many people didn't notice it. But Iran was at a crossroads right after the revolution, and there were very powerful elements on both sides pushing the nation toward, or leading the nation toward, freedom and democracy and an open, liberal, democratic society with respect for religion, of course. And that was represented by the Freedom Movement of Iran, of which my father is the Secretary General. And on the other side were more religious conservative elements who really had no history with democracy and no value for popular sovereignty.
So that brings us to the present day. Talk a little bit about the content of your father's letter. He wrote in part, "I pray that God protect you from repeating the mistakes we have made in Iran." And as I mentioned earlier, he wrote this to the leader of Tunisia's moderate Islamist party. What mistakes is he referring to?
In that period of time, that first year after the revolution, when Iran was at a crossroads, a lot of the liberal democratic forces started squabbling amongst themselves. So the freedom movement was trying to rally all democratic opposition and democratic forces to make Iran a more of a democracy. But there was so much infighting amongst them that it resulted in the back of the scenes, there was a very powerful, well-organized, motivated, religious conservative movement that basically was able to bring forces out to the street. And I think the biggest mistake was among political leaders that they did not realize the danger that faced them, that's waiting there, much more organized, much more disciplined forces. And I think the same thing, I can see it in Egypt and places like Tunisia, where you have radical forces waiting in the wings, very powerful, organized, and they can step in at any minute. And it's really important for democratic forces to unite and know the danger that's facing them.
You know, a big part of your father's letter, in fact, is devoted to the importance of protecting minority rights and diversity of opinion. I think this really comes to speaks to a kind of a fundamental question that I think many people have about whether it is possible to have a fundamentalist presence as part of government, because these people obviously deeply believe that their way is the right way. Is it possible to have a coalition government with that point of view as part of it?
You hit the nail on the head. Can a very deeply devout religious person compromise when it comes to national interest? One of the elements of the letter is that even a devout person, when it comes to practicality and implementing practical rules and governance, that it's acceptable to make compromises, because you need to do that in order to secure the benefit of the whole nation. You can't impose your values on the whole nation.
Well, the history of Iran would suggest that you can, because they are.
You can at great peril, not without harm to the nation. And basically, that has happened in Iran, and it has resulted in tremendous harm to the nation. I think that's the lesson, that religious people need to realize that compromise is acceptable. It's a practical part of our religion. If you look at the history of our prophet, he made great compromises in the course of his political campaign, and I think that's something we all need to take to heart.
You know, given your father's difficult history with the regime post the revolution and post his service in the government, are you hopeful about this chapter, that this will have a positive end?
I think so, and part of it has to do with his experience here in the U.S. I mean, he was here in the 60s and 70s, and as you know, that was the heyday of the anti-Vietnam War movement and the civil rights movement in the U.S., and he was really inspired by the potential for nonviolent action to really change the reality of a nation. And that's been the path of the freedom movement over the last 30 years, nonviolent reform of the system. And it's darkest before the dawn, to use a phrase that's been quoted a lot. But I think Iran is at that dark point. But the path that they've taken in nonviolent resistance is starting to show fruit, that within the regime itself, there's an erosion of support for the more radical elements. And increasingly, you see within the families even of regime supporters, there is a movement over to in the direction of supporting a more open and free society.
Yusuf Yazdi is the son of the well-known Iranian dissident Ibrahim Yazdi. He, the younger Mr. Yazdi, heads the Center for Bioengineering Innovation and Design at Johns Hopkins University, but he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we are going to talk about the kinds of things you could be doing now to get a jump on your taxes. How fun is that? But first, we're going to take a look at what's being called the most important Supreme Court ruling on religious freedom in this country in decades. The case involved Cheryl Parrish. She'd been a teacher at a Lutheran-run school in Michigan. She'd taken some time off due to a medical condition and was not welcomed back. She threatened to sue, and the school later fired her. Parrish pressed forward with a lawsuit claiming that her firing violated laws against discrimination. The case eventually made its way to the Supreme Court. Last week, the court sided with the school in a unanimous decision. The ruling asserted that the firing was justified due to a, quote, ministerial exception to laws that ordinarily protect employees from workplace discrimination. We wanted to talk about just what this means, so we've called upon, once again, Eva Rodriguez. She's a Washington Post editorial writer who specializes in legal affairs. She's also a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times. Thanks so much for joining us once again. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks.
Just, you know, we're so used to hearing how polarized this court is, especially on hot-button issues. How unusual is it to have a unanimous decision in a case like this?
I think in a case like this, it's rare. I was shocked, to be honest with you, that it was 9-0. I expected those justices, who we tend to think of as more liberal, to have more trouble, if you will, with granting the church an exception from applying discrimination, retaliation laws. I was shocked.
Well, in fact, the Obama administration had argued that her case should be essentially the same, whether she'd been employed by a church, a labor union, a social club, or any other group with free association rights under the First Amendment. And the reason I'm highlighting the Obama administration here, they didn't bring this case, but they had sided with Cheryl Parrish. And the court did not buy that argument. What did they say?
They didn't buy it at all. They said, dear Mr. President, look at the Constitution, the First Amendment. And while labor unions and churches do enjoy affiliation, that religion is specifically and especially protected under the First Amendment. And so to that extent, something that a church would be protected from, a lawsuit against discrimination. A labor union might very well be vulnerable to that. Religion has a special place in the Constitution, and all nine justices agreed.
Now, tell me about this ministerial exception argument. This is something that critics of the decision are pointing to. Now, she was not an ordained minister, but she had had religious training. I mean, she was called upon to teach religion as one of her subjects, but that took about like 45 minutes out of the school day.
Right.
So tell me more about this ministerial exception and why is that the core of this decision?
Right. It's important to understand, I think, that in the Lutheran church and in Lutheran schools, there are two classes of teachers. A lay teacher, someone who may not even be Lutheran, who is a contract teacher for a year. Maybe you can get extension. And then there are called teachers. These teachers, and Ms. Parrish was one of those, go through special training, religious seminars, and they are called, they are essentially ordained by the church to come and teach. That is a permanent position. And in fact, it's looked upon as, you know, without the title of minister, it is looked upon as a religious leader within the community. And especially when working with kids, you are the person who on a daily basis is bringing forth, you know, teaching the faith to the next generation.
What was the specific action that triggered her firing? And that is, I think, the part that some people are puzzled by.
It's really interesting, and it's not what I would have thought. What triggered her firing was her threat to sue. And the Lutheran Church came back, excuse me, and said, you know, according to our teachings, and they point to 1 Corinthians, every dispute within the church has to be handled within the church. And it's understood that you cannot, you should not go to an outside secular court. And, you know, I'm not a Lutheran. I'd never heard of this. But in fact, it's part of the doctrine. And if we're to respect religious freedom, it may not be something that is part of my church or my synagogue or my mosque. But we have to respect those differences. And that's what the court ultimately said.
Now, there are people like, obviously, the, you know, the Conference of Catholic Bishops and other large national denominations with a large presence are hailing this ruling as a very important guarantor of their religious rights, religious freedom rights, and the right to practice their religion in the way they see fit. What are some of the critics saying?
The critics are saying, well, if this teacher who didn't have the title of minister, who is not a priest or a rabbi, could be vulnerable to retaliation by the church, who wouldn't be, right? The laws don't apply to the church or to the synagogue or to any religious organization. The court was very clear in saying, look, we're deciding this case very narrowly. We don't know if tomorrow a janitor who worked at the school but is not a Lutheran, is not called, brings a retaliation suit, we may very well let that go. They said, we're not going to make a big sweeping decision here, as important as this is, because we don't know what other permutations are to follow. They're sort of keeping their powder dry.
Now, what about, they're saying as denominations like the Salvation, they didn't say this specifically in the decision, but denominations like the Salvation Army, and for those who don't know, it is in fact a religious denomination, but a majority of the employees who work in the ministries that are so well known around the country are not members of that specific denomination.
Mm-hmm.
They would not be covered. But you're saying a person who is an ordained minister, and that is a term that is specific to some denominations and others, people who fall within, if they have a dispute, they're expected to follow the religious tenets.
Yes.
And that is covered.
Yes. Someone who is specifically tapped, whether the word is ordained or what have you, someone who is tapped by the church and who is looked upon by the church as a religious leader is probably not going to be able to avail themselves of discrimination and retaliation laws that, you know, those who aren't would be.
What if someone were to resign his or her vows, as it were, to renounce his or her vows or to be released from his or her vows?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know what happens then. I mean, think about a priest who wants to get married, leaves the church, and then comes back and says, you know, I'm suing you for discrimination because I wanted to get married. He probably wouldn't prevail because after
all. Or sexual harassment, let's say. There have been a number of, as we mentioned last week, this was the 10th anniversary of the revelation of the sexual abuse scandal directed at children in the Boston Archdiocese, which was a huge scandal with, you know, ongoing repercussions.
Right. Well, I think that the court was a little bit opaque here, but fairly clear, that if we're talking about violation of criminal laws, this ministerial exception probably would not apply. If you were a church worker and you're reporting the abuse of a child to law enforcement officials, that in and of itself is not a religious tenet that you're violating, and it will probably be okay for you to go forward. But again, they didn't, you know, talk about this specifically, saying we'll deal with that when and if it arises.
Eva Rodriguez covers legal affairs for The Washington Post. She writes about them for the editorial board. She's also a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times. And she's telling us about the recent Supreme Court ruling that provides an exception to employment discrimination laws in cases involving churches and religious organizations. We're talking about the so-called ministerial exception. This was a rare unanimous ruling by this court. Eva, finally, did any of the people who the sort of commonly described as liberal wing of the court speak out specifically about this? We know that the decision itself was written by the Chief Justice?
Yes.
John Roberts. And of course, Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, I believe, also wrote a concurring opinion.
Right.
Did any of the so-called liberal wing have their own voice on this? And what did they say if they did?
There was a third opinion here. I mean, again, agreeing with the whole, but Justice Alito with Justice Kagan, President Obama's second nominee to the Supreme Court, joined Justice Alito's concurrence. And what they basically said is, let's not place too much importance on the word minister in the ministerial exception, because after all, there are no ministers in synagogues, in the Jewish religion. There are no ministers specifically in Islam. So let's make clear that you don't have to be a minister going forward to be bound by this. So in a way, Justice Kagan may have even gone a little further than the Chief Justice, the more conservative Chief Justice, went.
And pointing out, as Justice Alito added, that the concept of ordination should not be at the center of the analysis, because one, that kind of sacramental authority is conferred in different ways according to different faith traditions.
Right.
Should we read anything into the fact that Justice Kagan join Justice Alito in this decision, or specifically to write a concurring opinion?
What struck me was that, A, she joined, you know, a concurrence by one of the most conservative justices on the court, and B, seemed to want to take great care in saying it's not just Christian ministers, right? It would be a whole body of religious leaders who are covered, and they may be called different things, perhaps even at different times. I thought that was interesting. I don't know that I would read way too much into it in terms of, you know, the jurisprudence, but I thought it was interesting that she wanted to be perfectly clear that more than just the Christian, you know, religion and Christian ministers and those who are ordained would be covered by this.
Eva Rodriguez is an editorial writer with The Washington Post. She specializes in legal affairs, and as we said, she's a former editor-in-chief of Legal Times, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Eva, thanks so much for joining us
once again. Thanks for having me.
Now, switching gears to matters of personal finance. A lot of us are looking forward to spring. I don't know anybody, though, who enjoys one of the rituals of the season, filing taxes. This year, the deadline is April 17th, but that pair of extra days probably still won't keep a lot of us from scrambling to file at the last minute. So for our Money Coach conversation today, we thought we'd give you a head start. Joining us to share some tax tips for jumping on top of this Rite of Spring is David Baldoza. He's a senior accountant with Hobe & Lucas. That's an accounting and financial service company in Cleveland. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you very much for having me on.
So let me just start by stating the obvious, that a lot of people, taxes makes their head hurt. You know, they just hate the whole idea. And so probably that's one reason why they put it off as long as possible. Is there something that people should be doing right now to minimize the pain at the end of the process?
Well, it's never too early to start getting organized, Michelle. You'll start getting your forms in already, and in the next few weeks, you should have most of them by the middle of February. So as they come in, it's good to set aside a space to organize those documents and keep them handy so that when you're ready to do your own taxes, or if you decide to hire a preparer, they'll be there, they'll be organized, and everyone can get done a little more quickly.
Now, obviously, there are some people who are used to this idea, the easy form, and there's people who itemize and there are people who don't. Is there a rule of thumb determining whether you should consider itemizing or not, especially because that short form looks so tempting. I could just be done. Throw it in there. But are there people who definitely should itemize?
Well, let's talk about the standard deduction for just a second. That's basically a government freebie, and it is to give a deduction to those who don't have the types of deductions necessary to itemize. And those itemized deductions would be primarily mortgage interest, real estate taxes, state and local income taxes, charitable contributions, and the like. And a lot of folks who don't own a home or do not don't live in a state that has high state or local income taxes may not have enough itemized deductions to do that. But those are the big ones.
So a mortgage, something like that. Now, are there items that you can itemize that people commonly forget? I'm not talking about your swimming pool in the Cayman Islands. Okay, so let's just set that to the side. I'm not talking about your second house in the Maldives. Okay, that's not what I meant.
Yeah. Well, they can deduct mortgage interest on more than one home. They can also deduct their primary mortgage interest and to a degree their home equity interest. So they may have two mortgages that they may be able to deduct on their tax return, and additional real estate taxes. And a lot of the employee business expenses often get glossed over.
Well, like because what? Like dues for a professional association or something like that?
Sure. You have professional dues, union dues, uniforms. If you're required to wear a uniform and your company does not reimburse you for them, you may be able to deduct that on your return. And there's also home office expenses. But these are all subject to what's called the 2% of AGI limitation, which is why they're not available for everybody. So you have to calculate your income, and then you have to take 2% of that, and that amount will be disallowed from those certain deductions.
Okay. What about people who made very little? For example, are there deductions for people who maybe received unemployment for part of the year?
Well, the deductions for folks who don't make a lot of money are typically the standard deduction, and there is also the personal exemption that almost everybody gets. So you can take your income and lop off the first, $8,000 to $12,000 of income, and not worry about being taxed on that.
But unemployment is
taxable income.
Unemployment is taxable income. Okay.
If you collect enough of it, yes, to get over those standard deductions and exemptions.
What about the mileage, the stationery, and the letter that you sent for all the letters that you might have sent looking for a job? Job search expenses. Are those deductible? Well,
yes, those are also subject to the 2% miscellaneous itemized limitation. However, certainly the letters you sent, any job hunting expenses to get a job in your current industry or your current or your most recently former employment would be deductible. You can't deduct expenses to get a job in a totally new line of work.
So all those classes I took in massage therapy, I can't deduct those?
You cannot deduct expenses to meet the minimum requirement of your profession.
Those yoga classes? None of that?
Yes.
Oh, no. That's going to be bad news for somebody.
If you need to be a licensed, for example, myself, I could not deduct my CPA preparation classes because in my industry, being a CPA is one of the minimum requirements for the industry.
I bet you wish you had joined me in that massage therapy class, though, don't you?
I think about that a lot between January and April 17th, yes.
I bet. David Valdoza is a senior accountant with Hobe & Lucas. That's an accounting and financial service company in Cleveland. And he was nice enough to join us from our NPR member station, WCPN. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy parenting advice. Now, you might have heard stories about adult children moving back in with their parents or grandparents coming to stay with their children. Well, according to the Pew Research Center, one in six Americans now lives in a household like that. That's more than a 10% increase since 2007. So today we thought we would like to talk about the blessings and the challenges of these multi-generational living arrangements. We're joined now by Catherine Newman. She's the author of a new book. It's just out today, called The Accordion Family. She's a sociology professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's also the mom of a 22-year-old son who's living at home. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us, Elizabeth Fox. She's a mother of two and grandmother of two. Her daughter's family moved in with her 6 years ago. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to meet you.
And Rebecca Aguilar is the mom of one teenage son. Her father-in-law has lived with her family for the past 10 years. Nice to hear from you, too.
Hi there.
Well, Catherine Newman, let's start with you. Your book comes out today. What is an accordion family? I mean, for a lot of people, that's just normal, isn't it?
Well, it hasn't been normal for quite some time, but basically an accordion family is a multi-generational household in which you have adult children over the age of 21 living with their parents. And actually, that has not been the norm in the middle class for some time. It would have been the norm before the Second World War, but it really hasn't been for some time now.
And what's driving that?
It reflects the economic difficulties that young people find themselves in.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that, if you would. I interrupted you. It's just this is relatively recent because of the economy, which seems to be hitting younger people, younger workers, very hard.
Exactly. Now, that said, it's actually a trend that's been in play for some time now. So it's not unique to the recession we've been mired in. But really, ever since about the early 1980s, we've seen a pretty steady increase in the proportion of young people of this age group that have been either moving back with their parents or who don't leave in the first place. And that's mainly because the economy has been changing in ways that make it difficult for young people to find entry-level employment that really pays enough for them to be independent. As well, in the middle class, where we see ambitions for professional futures, it takes longer and longer and more money to achieve the kind of educational credentials needed to launch a middle-class professional life. So we see young people who complete college and move back in with their parents in order to shelter those costs of a master's degree or experience with an internship where they're not earning any money at all in the hopes of launching at a higher level when they get a bit older.
Hmm. Elizabeth Fox, you actually call your home Project Intergenerational Living. Tell us a little bit more about that. How was it decided that your daughter and her family would move back in with you?
Well, unlike some of what Catherine mentioned, both our children got as far away as they could after college. They were 15 years out in California. But our daughter and her family, when they had children, basically, decided to come east and started with us. And after a few months, we said, well, you don't really need to look for a house way out there in the burbs where you could afford it. Stay here. And that's what happened.
And there was no it sounds so smooth. Was it really that smooth?
It was a pretty smooth transition there. It just, we were able to share the costs of renovating the house somewhat so everyone had some privacy. And we were bonded with the grandchildren by then, and all the benefits were starting to come.
Okay. Rebecca Aguilar, how about you? You have a teenager and an 84-year-old in the same house. How did that arrangement come about?
Well, we kind of started talking about it a long time ago when I married my husband. We were living in Los Angeles, and my father-in-law would come and visit with my mother-in-law, and I just adored him because, you know, every time I'd leave for work, I'd come back, and here's this huge lasagna dinner, and I'm thinking, I need this man in my life. And so we would take these long walks. It was great, and I always say, hey, Pops, that's what I call him, Pops. I was like, if anything ever happens to Betty, I want you to move in with us. And he's like, you're crazy. I go, no, I really do. And I kind of wanted him to move in before my mother moved in. But anyway, and so what happened is, sure enough, unfortunately, my mother passed away in 2001. And I said, Pops, you know, if you want to move in with us, you know, I didn't want him to be alone. I live in Texas and he lived in Long Island and I didn't want him to be alone. And I'm Mexican-American. So both my parents, their families took in their parents. So it's kind of a cultural thing with us, too. So we, in our family, my brothers and sisters, we had already talked about who's going to take in our parents. It's just part of our culture. And so my father-in-law moved in, and it's been the best. It has been – my 15-year-old adores him. They do a lot of things together. It's rebuilt the relationship between his son and himself because, you know, I mean, they didn't really talk a lot when they were under the same roof. And now, you know, they're recapturing that time. And it's wonderful. And he's great. I'm a reporter by profession. So when I have to go out of town, you know, I trust my father-in-law. I trust that my father-in-law is in good hands with my 15-year-old and my 15-year-old is in good hands with my 84-year-old father-in-law.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about multi-generational living. We're talking about the challenges and the blessings of having grandparents, parents, adult children, all under one roof, teenagers, kids. We're talking with Rebecca Aguilar. That's who was speaking just now. Her household includes her husband, teenage son, and father-in-law. Elizabeth Fox is also with us. Her daughter and grandchildren live with her. And also with us, Catherine Newman, sociology professor at Johns Hopkins University. Her new book is called The Accordion Family, where she talks about this. Now, Professor Newman, I'm not investigating for pain here, but the families, the moms we're speaking with, this has worked out nicely. It seems to be a wonderful arrangement that just provides a sense of kind of mutual, you know, support. But I'm thinking for some people, there's probably some shame attached to this. You can see a scenario where the arrangement isn't as welcome. Can you describe a little bit of that? I know you talk about that in the book. What are the circumstances in which this doesn't seem to be working out as well?
It's more complicated in households where the young person who's rejoined the family isn't making progress toward a more independent future. If Johnny is playing video games in the basement and seems to be avoiding the hard choices and difficult aspects of growing up and taking his place ultimately in some adult role, then that can be a source of real frustration. Or if the young people in the house aren't pulling their own weight, if they expect to be treated or cared for as they did when they were little children, that can get to be frustrating for their parents, especially if both parents are working for a living. So, you know, I'm actually pleased to say that much of the time this works out exceptionally well, as has been described by your guests, because in many accordion families, the return of the young adult provides an opportunity for parents to get to know their children as equals or as something closer to equals because they subtract out all of those onerous responsibilities for surveillance. You know, is Mary home at midnight? What is Johnny doing at 2 a.m? All those, you know, are they getting their homework done? Those are the kinds of questions that they had to entertain when those young people were teenagers and the official responsibility of their parents. But if they return at the age of 23 or 24, they're a little bit more like autonomous adults, a little bit more like roommates or boarders with a lot of affection thrown in on the side. And for baby boom parents who worked their way through their children's childhood and adolescence, they may not have had as much time with them as they would like. And so when those young people return as more independent, not completely independent clearly, but more independent adults, maybe even contributing to the household, as is true for your guests, then it can be a very pleasurable experience, as long as it looks like it's got an endpoint in which everyone assumes the roles that society assigns to them, which includes a degree of autonomy and self-determination and responsibility for that young adult.
Well, Elizabeth, that's interesting because your arrangement doesn't have an endpoint.
No. We all went into this with the idea that it's forever, and I would say that if you look at some of the reasons why people do this, most often it is economic. We do have financial savings for our housing costs, which we share 50-50. And for my husband and me, that was a substantial savings. And for them as well, they can live in a better place, a better location, not commute and all that. But I think that the strains would be great if you're one of the many people in this circumstance who are really barely making it. I think the financial constraints are just, you know, huge, and if you're sharing them with more people who are in that situation. The other thing is that if you as a grandparent did not respect your children's parenting, that would be very hard for all of you, and that's not at all the case with us, fortunately.
How does dinner work out? How do you do dinner?
Oh, you hit on the one strain. The kitchen, you know, about group homes, those who've lived in group, it's kind of the same, you know. But we are pretty highly scheduled. We have a calendar up on our computers and, you know, who's doing the dinners and who's doing the transportation of the boys to school and so on. So I would say we've got it as managed as well as possible.
So you've got a schedule, like who's going to do dinner on what night
who's
going to do it. So does your daughter ever say, Mom, you're not cutting it? You're not pulling your weight on the dinner thing? That's too much takeout on your night?
We have a monthly meeting. That's got its own agenda. Check off things, try to raise things so they don't become problems.
Wow. Does everybody get an equal vote kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah. Well, do the boys get an equal vote? Probably not quite.
Well, that's interesting. Rebecca, what about you? Are there any pressure points for you? Are there any strains for you?
Wow, I keep listening to everybody. I don't seem as organized. We kind of wing it. I mean, it's just I didn't really have any rules. I just said, you know, mi casa es tu casa kind of thing. My home is your home. I didn't want my father-in-law. I don't know. He was just such an easygoing guy. I mean, like I said, I love my mother, but it would have been a whole different dynamic with her. So with my father-in-law, we didn't do it for, because of financial reasons or anything like that. We did it because I just didn't want my father-in-law to live alone.
What about for your husband? Because you don't have to relive adolescence with him. But what about your husband?
Oh, he said I married the perfect woman because he was so happy. He couldn't believe that I wanted to take in Pops. And for him, it's been great. I mean, they spend time together. They have lunch together. It's been great. I think it's also helped our marriage because, you know, it shows that, hey, I am in love with this man if I took in his father. So it's been great. And you were talking about dinner. That's an interesting point, too, because sometimes, again, we wing it. But I remember one of the things my father-in-law had to learn was how to eat Mexican food. And so I remember one time I made some tacos, and he's looking at it with his fork and knife like, okay, how do I do this? Do I dig into it, or what do I do? And I finally said, Pops, you just pick it up and eat it. And I hear, let me show you how. And so it's been a cultural thing because, you know, one of the things that I've taught him a lot about, you know, the culture, the Latino culture, other cultures, because, again, he grew up in a whole different generation where, you know, there was separated the blacks and the whites and the Latinos and the whites. And so it's been great for him. And many times he's like, you know, gosh, I learned a lot from you, Rebecca. And I said, I too. He was in World War II. So I relive a lot of the history that happened in the past. We're in the now. And that's what's wonderful about it.
That is interesting. That sounds okay. But again, Catherine, I don't want to be Debbie Downer here, but I am still thinking of the scenario where the young person wishes he or she were not there. Okay. And I'm just wondering how that plays out, where you were saying that the tension often arises if the senior members, let's say the senior members of the household, don't feel that the younger person is pulling his or her weight. But what about if that younger person feels that he or she's doing everything possible and isn't advancing? I'm just wondering how that plays out, because I'd have to confess, I know a lot of young people in my community where, you know, this is an area where housing costs are high. There's a lot of competition for, you know, these fellowships and internships that are highly desirable. And some of these young folks are ashamed that they're living at home at this stage of their lives. And
I think that shame factor is actually declining because this is becoming so common. We have such an enormous group of people who are returning home, and it's not an aberration anymore. It's almost become a normal part of the life cycle. So people tend to feel shame when they're at odds with the currents in their generation. I will say, though, that there is tremendous frustration amongst young people today because of the way in which the economy has hammered their options. And, you know, we're often talking about people whose families have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars putting them through college, only to discover that they really don't have the kinds of professional options that those degrees were supposed to put them in line for. So there is a lot of frustration that has to do with what a bad hand the labor market is dealing to young people today. And if they happen to be in families where there's very little understanding of how difficult that is, and where their actions are attributable by their parents only to their personal whims or personalities and no recognition of how hard that jungle is out there, then it can lead to a tremendous amount of strain. And I've studied this issue in the book in six different countries, and you see real variations in the way different cultures define what's normal and what's a source of shame and frustration, just as your guests have talked about how Mexican culture defines certain things as normal that might not be regarded that way in other communities. Well, in Japan, for example, the phenomenon of the accordion family is something of a national catastrophe. It's treated that way. It is the subject of an almost hysterical outburst of criticism within the country and gnashing of teeth and defining of the younger generation as completely defective. But in Italy, where I've studied the same thing, it doesn't excite anything like that kind of negative view. It's much more like what your guests are describing. We love having our children at home. Why would they ever want to leave us? So, you know, Johnny is 35 years old and he's still living at home and his mom is doing his laundry. And her first question to me in interviews is, well, why would he ever want to leave me? So there are tremendous variations in how cultures define what we expect of people at different generations. And some things which are defined as problems by government, for example, because you can't run a social security system if you don't have new generations being born. And if people don't form new households, often that means they're not having children. Those same frustrations that worry policymakers don't really worry ordinary people all that much. They, you know, they've adapted as some of the people on your show have adapted and actually find it a happy situation.
Elizabeth, we only have a couple seconds left. Yeah. So I'm going to ask you, since I know you have a social work background in addition to just your own common sense, what's advice for people who are considering such an arrangement that you could pass on very briefly?
We haven't touched on old age. My husband and I are in our, quote, encore phase. We have a lot of outside activities. We're taking care of the kids. We all are aware that the true old age is going to come. Policymakers should be happy about this trend, and I think it's one thing in the bucket for people who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s to think about, both for financial and relationship purposes for their old age.
What is it that makes it work in your case? Is it that monthly meeting, or is it just because you all are so cool?
My husband and our daughter, we had a family where we had lots of people in our house for various reasons over, you know, her whole life.
Okay.
So, experience.
All right. Catherine Newman is author of the new book, The Accordion Family. It comes out today. She's also a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. We actually caught up with her in Cape Town, South Africa, where she's traveling. Elizabeth Fox is a mother of two and grandmother of two. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. That's who just had the last word. And Rebecca Aguilar has a teenage son and her 84-year-old father-in-law living with her and her husband. And she was with us from Dallas. Thank you all so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.